So I'm here with Dr. Emmett O'Connor, who is a senior lecturer in history at the University of Ulster, and he's here at Luxman Ireland House, NYU, to speak about the life of the Irish political and labour figure popularly known as Big Jim Larkin and his controversial involvement with the Socialist Party of America. It's great to have the opportunity, Professor O'Connor, to talk to you one-on-one about your research on Larkin, and specifically for a New York audience to hear about his activities here in New York. Can you tell me a little bit about how, looking at your list of publications, I suppose it's a natural progression for you to have gotten into Larkin? What was the origins of your research on Larkin himself?
Yeah, well, if you do Irish labour history, you can't avoid Big Jim Larkin. But I had no intention of writing a biography of Larkin until I was asked by Cork University Press back in the, I think it was 1998. They were producing a series called Radical Irish Lives at that time, and they asked me to do a short biography of Larkin, and I thought that's really no problem because there's a lot written about Larkin up to the 1913 lockout, and then there are very few sources on Larkin after the lockout. The perception of Larkin is that he was the great hero of the lockout, and he's not so much discussed before and after. But when I began to look into his subsequent career, I found that in fact there were quite a number of sources. There's an FBI file on Larkin which runs to almost 500 pages, and he also had a lot of contact with the Communist International in Moscow in the 1920s, and the Communists didn't throw a paper away, at least the Russians didn't. They kept very good archives, and all his correspondence with Moscow is detailed there. And of course that was completely inaccessible, or at least very difficult to get at, before the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. But subsequently they had a very liberal access policy in the mid-1990s. Mm-hmm. So all this material suddenly became available, and we now know quite a lot about Larkin, including his life after the lockout.
So I suppose the lockout is such a big event and moment in and of itself, and then it's followed so quickly after by other dramatic Irish history. Is that part of the reason that the story of him dropped off a little bit after the lockout?
Yeah, he kind of becomes displaced because he goes off to America the year after the lockout, and he kind of disappears really. He comes back then in 1923. Nothing much was known about the American years, but also when he came back, he was a very dictatorial character. He was a man with strong good points, strong bad points, very black and white character. And if you're trying to assess Larkin, you do end up saying, well, on the one hand and on the other hand, and so on. Mm-hmm. And in the 1920s, to some he was a hero, to some he was a villain. Mm-hmm. And I think after his death in 1947, the labour movement didn't quite know how to deal with his legacy and his memory. But when the 50th anniversary of the lockout came along in 1963, labour appreciated this was a hugely important event in Irish history. It was the one kind of big event in Irish labour history which sort of thrust itself into the mainstream narrative, but you couldn't really deal with the lockout without talking about Larkin. So a kind of consensus grew up that they would treat Larkin as the hero of the lockout and forget about what happened before, forget about what happened after. Because mm-hmm. when he came back, he wanted to restore his dictatorial control of the Union and get rid of the people who had taken over in the meantime. And they thought, well, you know, he went off to America when things were bad after the lockout. We rebuilt the Union. We stayed here during the struggle for independence, and some of us were arrested and interned, and some Union officials were shot and so on. And Larkin was off there in New York and places beyond. So they weren't going to accept Big Jim back as the boss, and that led to a split in the Union.
Specifically on Larkin and his role?
Yeah, I think the split has been kind of rationalised by some historians as a kind of an ideological split between right and left, with, you know, Larkin the revolutionary and the people who succeeded him as being more moderate. But I don't think that's valid. I think it was really just about Larkin wanted to, you know, he wanted his Union back. And he tried physically with some of his followers to take over control of the Union headquarters. He was expelled as General Secretary, and that led to a court case in 1924, which he lost. He was a very litigious kind of character. He then went off to Moscow in 1924, and it was in his absence that his brother Peter and his eldest son Young Jim founded the Workers' Union of Ireland. And there was a kind of civil war in the Dublin labour movement between the Transport Union and the Workers' Union for the next, you know, 30 and 40 years, right, which is really quite disastrous for the labour movement. But these two unions finally came back together as SIPTU in 1990.
What do you think, from your research, Larkin made of New York as a city, or the United States more generally? Did he enjoy his time here?
I think he did, although he did complain about it also. But the reason he came here was that Big Bill Haywood of the Wobblies, one of the, you know, the huge characters on the far left of the American labour movement, a leading figure in the industrial workers of the world, he suggested to Larkin that he might go on a speaking tour of the US during the 1913 lockout. And Larkin decided that he would like to go in December of 1913, but he didn't want to be seen as running away from the impending defeat for the Union, and the membership didn't want him to go. But the struggle against the Dublin employers was called off in January of 1914, and it was a huge setback for the Union. But they still believed in Larkin and in his leadership, which was a remarkable tribute to Larkin. But privately, he was canvassing about going overseas. He was writing to Butte, Montana. He was writing to friends in New York. He was writing to people in South Africa, Australia, New Zealand about a world speaking tour. And finally, he did leave then, arriving in New York in November of 1914. And the idea was that he would go on a lecture circuit in the US and then maybe go on to Canada and then maybe go on to Australia, New Zealand and so on. But he didn't get beyond the United States. It kind of went wrong for him because he sort of fell between two stools. He got involved with the leading Irish-American Republican group, Clonagail. Mm-hmm. And of course, they were now planning for a rising in Dublin with German help. And their leader, John Devine, was very happy to make use of Larkin as a speaker. But Larkin also wanted to work mainly with the American labour movement, and he got too close to the Nationalists for labour, and then he got too close to the far left for the Nationalists. And by the spring of 1915, he was finding it harder and harder to get speaking engagements. It's also, I think, to some extent, his oratorical style. He was a great gifted orator. He had a powerful, booming voice. He could talk for 3 or 4 hours at length without notes. But he had a terrible tendency to attack colleagues on the left or in the Nationalist movement, and this didn't go down too well. He wasn't at all diplomatic, and he was inclined to speak off the top of his head. So the kind of oratorical style which works so well at a strike meeting or on a street corner didn't go down so well, you know, in the more formal setting of a theatre, right, or a public hall. So that made it more difficult for him. But he finally got the Socialist Party to arrange a lecture tour of the Far West in the summer of 1915, and he went off to places like Fresno and San Francisco in California. He got good reviews for his lectures, but he couldn't make a living out of it. So he then took a job as an organizer for the Western Federation of Miners. Now, that wasn't the sort of work he wanted at all, because that's what he'd come to America to get away from, to get away from the drudgery of union work and to be an agitator rather than an organizer. So through his contacts in Clonagail and John Devine, he arranged a deal with the officials of the German embassy that he would undertake anti-war agitation in return for substantial sums of money from the Germans. The Germans had offered him this deal before and he turned it down because it wouldn't have gone down well with the American labor movement if they'd known that he was taking money from the Kaiser, as it were. The position of America at the time is that it was neutral. The American left was very largely against America being drawn into the war because they felt if it did join the war, it would be done so for profit, for big business, for the big munitions companies. But the problem for the Germans was that they couldn't trade with the US because of the British naval blockade. But the British and French were both trading and getting a lot of munitions from America. So in a purely industrial sense, America was on the side of the British and French. And it was a very frustrating situation for the Germans. So the money he got from the Germans allowed him to settle in Chicago for 2 years to bring his wife and 2 of his 4 children over from Dublin and to edit a newspaper, which is something that he always liked doing. So he put out a Chicago edition of the Irish Worker in 1916. But he broke with the Germans in 1917, or they broke with him. He claims that they were pushing him to undertake sabotage work and he didn't want to do that. Now, we only have his word for it. And with Larkin, you can't entirely rely on him. You know, he can be a bit selective in giving his version of events. But according to himself, they broke with him and left him penniless in Mexico City in October of 1917. He then went to the West Coast and started working with the Wobblies. And then in early 1918, he came back to New York, moved again into Greenwich Village. He seemed to like living in Greenwich Village and lived not too far from here in Patchen Place. And he joined the Socialist Party.
And he would have had his wife and kids with him then?
No, she had returned to Dublin in August of 1916. I think relations were getting a bit strained between the two because subsequently when Larkin was imprisoned in New York, she was approached to support a campaign for his release and she refused. So when he returned to Dublin in 1923, the two didn't live together again for the rest of their lives.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So were the two kids, they were old enough to stay in Ireland, the two of the four, is that the logic there?
Yeah, by this stage she had four children, four boys, and the youngest, Barney, had been born in August 1914, only 2 months before he left for America. So his wife, I think, had certain, you know, she felt she had been somewhat neglected by him, mm-hmm. that he'd always put the movement first, and he really was a man who was married to the movement, mm-hmm. and, you know, he wasn't much given to sort of home life and home duties and so on.
So is he actually then in New York City in 1916 when news of the rising breaks and stuff?
No, he's in Chicago at that time, right. Yeah.
And what, do you know what his reaction to that would have been and stuff like
yeah.
that?
Yeah, you see, he had this terrible problem with jealousy, and he was very jealous of James Connolly. People tend to think of Connolly and Larkin as kind of two, you know, co-equal leaders at the labour movement, but in fact Larkin was the main man, because Connolly was good at persuading people who were willing to sit down and listen to him, but he's not good at standing on street corners and bringing in the masses, mm-hmm. which Larkin could do. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Connolly had been in the US. He developed an international reputation as a very good propagandist. He'd written a few pamphlets which had been much praised in the labour movement. So he wasn't just your average union official, and any time Larkin scented a threat, the jealousy did tend to get the better of him. So when he was going to America, he wanted to appoint P.T. Daly in his place to take care of the union. But others in the union more or less forced him to appoint Connolly. So Connolly then took over as leader of the Transport Union and the Citizen Army. But Larkin knew that something was being prepared in Dublin, and he sent back two messages to Connolly to pull out of it, as he put it. Now, there's no difference between Larkin's politics and Connolly's politics. They were both Republicans. They were both very much against Britain and the war. They were both very much in favour of a rising. But Larkin didn't want anything happening if he wasn't a part of it. So he felt very upstaged when the news of the rising broke, and he went to ground. The newspapers in America were trying to contact him to get his views, and after a week the New York Times finally got through to him, and all he said was, "I have nothing to say on the Irish question."
Wow. That's phenomenal.
That is absolutely incredible, and it shows you what a difficult situation it must have been for him.
You would put it down to the jealousy?
I think there's no other explanation than the jealousy, mm. that this had a very depressing effect on him.
Wow.
But he did recover his composure after about 3 weeks, and he organised a meeting in the Grand Opera House in Chicago to commemorate the leaders. By this stage, Connolly and the others had been executed by the British, so he was now commemorating them as martyrs. But his nerves were very unsettled, and there was an incident when a man in the audience heckled, and Larkin physically attacked him. He ran from the stage and jumped on him. So he was obviously under a lot of pressure.
And you don't think it's possible that it was something like that, he was so devastated that Connolly had died or whatever like that?
But he said nothing.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so, because, I mean, had he been so annoyed, I mean, his deputy leader was imprisoned and then was going to be executed. He was still leader of, technically he was still leader of the Transport Union. I mean, he should have come out with a statement and, yeah. you know, organised some protests about mm-hmm. this when Connolly was still alive.
When Connolly's over, or does at least one tour, if memory serves me correctly, here, and he comes to, like, in New York City, and I assume he and Larkin would have crossed paths here in those years as well, right?
No, they didn't, because Larkin hadn't been to America by that stage. And Connolly was in America, mainly in New York, between 1903 and 1910.
Oh, okay, it was
so,
earlier.
Yeah,
okay.
So Larkin didn't arrive until November 1914.
Right.
Though he did use Connolly's contacts, including with the Flynns in the Bronx. And Elizabeth Gurley Flynn was celebrated as the Rebel Girl by Joe Hill. He wrote a song about her.
So would Larkin ever, at any point, Emmett, she was still alive, right, Mother Jones, would he have had contact with someone like her, do you know?
Not to my knowledge. He did have some contact with the Wobblies. He was careful not to join any one organisation to avoid sort of being pigeonholed, you know, or making a hostage to fortune. He wanted to be freelance. He always wanted to do his own thing in his own way, to do what he wanted, when he wanted, how he wanted, and he didn't want to have to answer to anyone for it.
Right.
You know, that was another of his vices.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd acquired, in some ways he became even more self-indulgent to America, because he got used to the kind of freelance wandering lifestyle. He loved travel. He did a huge amount of travel across the US, and when he joined the Socialist Party, he was hardly a member of the Socialist Party in New York before he set up his own club within the party and more or less broke with the party. He set up the New York James Connolly Socialist Club and just sort of moved into his branch headquarters and more or less ran the club from there.
So Larkin was the founder of that, James Connolly?
He was, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
And, I mean, that was quite influential over the years, you know, in terms of Irish socialism here,
yeah,
right?
It did attract a lot of the kind of leading Irish Labour and left-wing figures at the time. And of course, Larkin was, you know, he was a big name because he'd made his reputation worldwide as an agitator during the 1913 lockout.
Mm-hmm. Would Larkin have ever been happy to have spent the rest of his life here in the United States?
Well, he claims that from 1917 he was constantly trying to get back, and he did apply repeatedly to the British consulate in New York for a passport, but they wouldn't give him one because they didn't want him back in the UK. And in fact, they'd introduced a barring order on him in December 1914, banning him from the British dominions. So when he tried to enter Canada, he was refused entry to Canada.
Would that have been part of the reason as well that speaking tour was a little bit put off track in terms?
Yeah, it would have clipped his wings a little bit, yeah.
So he's interesting as well from the point of view, at least from a New York perspective, Emmett, in that he goes home in 1923 and within certainly 12 months or so, you know, hundreds of the Republicans who've been on the wrong side of the things going on in Ireland are kind of coming out, and who's doing a reverse migration to what we see in that post-Civil War period in Ireland. You know, he's going back in the opposite direction, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. He was arrested during a Red Scare in November of 1919, and he was sentenced to 10 years hard labour in May of 1920 and sent him to Sing Sing.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a campaign then for his release, and he was eventually pardoned by Al Smith, then governor of New York, in January of 1923, on the ground that he'd been in prison for his political beliefs, and he was really a political prisoner rather than for anything that he had actually done. What he intended to do next is, it's not entirely clear. He did try to raise funds to send a food ship back to Ireland to help refugees who were being forced out of Belfast by the Orange pogroms in Belfast at that time. But at the same time, he spoke about staying in America, he spoke about going elsewhere. Meanwhile, the FBI, and in particular J. Edgar Hoover, were trying to get rid of him. Hoover took the view that all this trouble was caused by all of these European agitators coming over here. What we need to do is get rid of these people. So Hoover's problem was that he really didn't have hard evidence that Larkin had actually broken the law. So they finally got a speech that he'd made in New York in early 1918, and they concluded that this amounted to advocating the overthrow of the government. You know, that was sort of pushing it a bit, because Larkin was always very careful not to give the authorities an excuse to arrest him.
Right.
But Hoover decided that that was it, and he had the evidence. So Larkin was arrested and then deported and sent back to Southampton. Now, the Civil War was just about coming to an end. He arrived back in Ireland on the 30th of April of 1923, and the Civil War was called off formally a few weeks later. The Republicans had high hopes of Larkin because he had been quite close to them here in the US, and they thought that he would rally the Labour movement behind the Republican movement in Ireland, because the people who'd taken over control of the Labour Party, they were much more moderate, they were more pro-free state. But Larkin was to disappoint the Republican movement in that respect, and they didn't quite trust him after that. But after the Civil War, it's true that a lot of Republicans found that they'd simply had to get out because it was just impossible to get work.
Mm-hmm.
And
I know many of them came here. In your research then, so the likes of De Vaux had a lot of respect for Larkin, do you think?
He did to begin with, yeah. He was a great admirer of Larkin, but he fell out with him by 1923 because, curiously, although De Vaux, you know, he was very much a hardline Irish Republican, he supported the treaty and supported the new Irish government, and so he and Larkin would have differed on that point. But also Larkin, of course, when he went back to Ireland, some people accused him of running away, you know, and being out of the country right throughout the whole troubled times. And he said that the real reason he'd gone to America was not to raise funds for his union, but in fact it was to work with people like John De Vaux to organise a rising and to get weapons from Germany for the rising in Dublin. And De Vaux was very annoyed about that and said that isn't the case, and published a big attack on Larkin in the Gaelic American,
right,
which is
his newspaper.
Yeah, his paper, yeah.
And do you, in your research, Emmett, have you a sense of how this period that Larkin's here in New York, even New York City alone, and even most of those other places that you mention in the US he ends up travelling to, there's substantial Irish-born populations in those communities. Do you have a sense as to how the average Irish immigrant here grubbing along in life in urban America, how they perceived Larkin?
That's, I think, is a bit more difficult to establish. He undoubtedly, he was a popular orator, and he always attracted big crowds, But at the same time, he was inclined to antagonize people and antagonize some Irish Americans because for his attacks on the US government.
Mm.
And he also suffered from the fact that some of his critics on the left were inclined to misrepresent him, and he was often referred to as an anarchist, which he wasn't. There was also another incident when he was supposed to refer to the US flag as a rag, and then he said he hadn't called it a rag, he said it was a Union Jack he was calling a rag, and so on.
Yeah.
These sort of things seemed to dog him at every turn. And of course he was operating on the far left, so I suppose the mainstream Irish Americans would not have subscribed to the kind of politics that he was advocating.
He's a product of the Irish diaspora himself. Would you mind telling us a little bit about his background in terms of his connections with Liverpool and his time in Scotland and things like that?
Yeah, he was born in Liverpool in 1874. Both of his parents came from around Newry. He would claim to have been born in the maternal family homestead in South Down and then taken to Liverpool at an early age. But I think most historians think that he was born in Liverpool. He certainly spoke with a broad Liverpool accent.
He did.
Throughout his life, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. But when he came to Ireland, it's remarkable he regarded himself as being Irish. Of course, he grew up in an Irish dockland community in Liverpool. But he had a strong affinity with Ireland all the time. But he's not known to have been in Ireland before 1907. When he would have been 33 years of age. But once he did come to Ireland, he adjusted to the country very quickly, and he brought his wife to join him. So obviously he was thinking of settling in Ireland long term, whereas when he'd been in Scotland, you know, he hadn't asked his wife to join him. And when he came to Ireland, he would always insist that he was an Ulster man. Throughout his life, he called himself an Ulster man.
So his wife was a Liverpudlian as well?
Yeah, she was from a very different background. They had a different kind of character and outlook, and I mean, one of their grandchildren described him as a marriage of chalk and cheese. She was the daughter of a Baptist lay preacher, Elizabeth Brown was her name, and her father ran a temperance cafe. So Larkin was a strong advocate of temperance throughout his life. His idea of taking her out and showing her a good time would be to take her to a socialist meeting in Liverpool. But the two, they bonded, they got married in 1903. Curiously, it was a civil ceremony. They got married in a registry office in 1903. Larkin always had a kind of an ambiguous attitude to religion. He always regarded himself as a Catholic, but he's not known to have practiced until a sort of a deathbed conversion in 1947. But when he was filling in the 1911 census in Dublin, for example, mm-hmm. he not only put himself and the children down as Catholics, but his wife too was listed as a Catholic.
Even though there's no record of her ever converting?
No, there's not.
Like
no,
that.
No, there's not.
It strikes me, Emmett, in talking to you that, you know, as you kind of said, he's kind of a mercurial figure. They're a lot of fun to investigate as historians, aren't they? You know, the forward and back in terms of the swings and turns of someone like that. It's been an enriching research journey for you.
Yeah, quite amazing, really, because when I started out looking at Larkin, I didn't think there was much left, much new to be said on him, because he didn't keep any private papers. You know, his coat pocket was his filing cabinet, and whatever he needed, he would sort of carry around, you know, on his person, and didn't bother with any record, even when he was head of the union. But as I say, he was a very mercurial character. You know, strong good points, strong bad points. You could argue about Larkin all night. And he had such an interesting life, you know, going from Liverpool to Ireland, the United States, Mexico, then back to Ireland, and then he made four visits to Moscow in the 1920s. And then there were so many sides to him. You know, he was a socialist, he was a Republican, a trade union leader, and then the interesting questions of his relations with his wife and his family, particularly his brother Peter, who was here in New York for a time, and his attitude to things like religion, which were quite ambiguous as well.
Mm-hmm.
So he is an endlessly fascinating character.
Well, listen, Emmett, thanks for taking time out of your schedule to sit down and share with us your insights on this fascinating figure. I'm delighted that the Labour Historians and Archivists Gathering has brought you to the campus, and thanks for coming into Ireland House.
Thank you very much.